Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
This session was recorded on the 16th of February 2012 at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, located in Melbourne CBD. The session was jointly organised by Ovarian Cancer Australia and Brecan in acknowledgement of Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. Professor David Botell is head of the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study, a collaborative national project involving over 2,000 women with ovarian cancer. In this talk, he presents on the latest research and developments in ovarian cancer. We hope that you enjoy this session.
Hello everyone. I'll try to speak up. I understand, Nick, that I should be talking for 45, 50 minutes, something like that. And as Nick said, I'm very happy to have some questions as we go through it. This is a bit of a roadmap for the talk. I'm very conscious of the fact that there'll be people here with different backgrounds, perhaps people that are well aware of the science, but often it's a very specialist area. So I'll try to pitch it so that it's hopefully understandable. In every field of human endeavour these days has become very specialised and has a language of its own, and modern medicine is no exception in that sense. And so some of the concepts are going to be can be a little bit hard to get your head around and so on. So throughout the talk, I'm going to try and use some analogies. So for people who know something about this, I apologise in advance that if they seem a bit hokey and so on, but hopefully it'll help those that are less familiar with some of the things about genes and the things that I'll be talking about to understand. And as I said, if you need clarification as we go through it, don't hesitate to put up your hand and say, slow down or go faster or something. So I'm just going to talk very briefly about my background. I'll say a couple of things in a very general sense about my own lab's research directions and a couple of things about the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study, which Nick has mentioned already. And then really the key part of the talk is going to be about, I guess, really sort of four things. Talk a bit about ovarian cancer and how just in the last couple of years, really surprisingly, we've found out that it's not exactly what we thought. And I'll explain that in a bit more. I'll talk about genetic risk because there's been some really very important things in that field just recently. In fact, we have a study that will be published in a couple of weeks that I think will change the way that genetic risk is managed for ovarian cancer around the world. I'm going to talk a bit about early detection because that's something that, you know, has been really a holy grail for ovarian cancer, but I think it's also important to understand why that has been so difficult to solve. And finish off by talking a little bit about some of the new therapies. And I won't go into a lot of detail there, but what I'll try and do is give you a bit of context about why we think or how we understand these therapies work and how we're trying to essentially transform this disease from the current situation to one where we manage it like we would manage blood pressure or cholesterol or something like that. That's really kind of the goal. Okay, so my background, briefly. So I'm not a clinician. I'm actually, of all things, I trained initially as a veterinarian but never practiced, went straight into... It was very odd to say that when I was the director of research at Peter Mac that I was actually a vet, and people would sort of look at that very strangely. But I never practiced. I went straight into medical research when I finished and did a PhD at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. Some of you might know that. And then essentially learnt to become a molecular biologist, a genetic engineer, I guess. My lab, though, focuses on human cancer genetics and is basically focused on ovarian cancer. We work on some other cancers of unknown primary, which is a disease that a lot of people haven't heard about, but very important one. But my main focus is on ovarian cancer. For the last 10 years, or for 10 years, I was director of research at Peter Mac, and that was sort of my day job, and it took up a lot of my time. And during that time, the study that I'll describe, the AOCS, was developed. And since I've been able to go back to full-time research, we're now sort of churning out, particularly from our lab, a lot more results, and I'll talk about that a bit. I'm the head of the Cancer Genomics and Genetics Program, so this is a program with about 5 labs, about 80 people, that's up on the 3rd floor of Peter Mac if you ever visit it. I have a university appointment, and I'm a member of a number of clinical groups because our work is very focused on clinical outcomes, so Australian groups, and I'm also involved in US and European studies. And just to say that this is just not just an academic exercise for me. This is a picture of my parents a number of years ago. And that's my dear old mum, who unfortunately died of ovarian cancer now 16 years ago. So I think, when it comes to cancer, we all have some skin in the game in some ways. And so I just think, particularly for this audience, it's important to say that do have some understanding of the disease. Okay, don't look down. Okay, so our research directions and AOCS. So about 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, we started a really active program of research in ovarian cancer. And the we in this case was myself and 4 other senior scientists, 2 of them in Queensland, Georgia Shenevix-Trench, and Adele Green, actually, and Penny Webb, 3 in Queensland, and Anna DeFazio in Sydney. And initially, there was another investigator, an epidemiologist, Dorota Gertig, who was involved in the study. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to really try and take apart ovarian cancer and really make some significant progress with that. And we recognised to do that, we needed to recruit a large group of women who had the disease, who were presenting for surgery with ovarian cancer, and to collect their biospecimens with their permission. They had to be consented into the study, a blood sample, and very detailed clinical information and dietary information about them. And it, of all things, it was funded by the US Department of Defense for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with shooting people. The DOD has a very large program of research in cancer research, and not cancers that are necessarily anything related to the military. And one of those programs is in ovarian cancer. By DOD, yeah. So they have the ovarian cancer research program within the DOD, congressionally directed medical research program. And they had funded a lot of research in the United States, and they had a call for programs in ovarian cancer, and it was an international competition. And as far as I know, we're the only ones that ever won a program grant outside the United States. And it was to do this, to recruit a cohort of, we said, 1,000 women who were presenting for surgery with ovarian cancer and 1,000 controls, and then to collect the samples and to follow them. And in the end, we recruited 2,500 women. And the study has become the largest study of its kind in the world. And we were able to do something in Australia that no one else has been able to do anywhere else in the world, and to recruit these women and to follow them and to collect their information and to be able to relate that to the things that I'm going to describe today. And AOCS has turned out to be a resource that has been used now for about 70 or 80 different projects. There are nearly 100 publications that have resulted from this. We've supported projects in the United States and the UK and in Canada and Japan and Norway, as well as Australia. So AOCS is an ongoing sort of core resource that acts as a foundation on which we've built a whole series of research programs. And the grant process is underway at the moment, and everyone around Australia is busy writing grants, and people are writing to us asking to access AOCS to put into their grants for their grant proposals. So it's enabled a great deal of research. It's involved a lot of people. I've led the study, but it's involved over 100 people. Some of you will recognise some of the clinicians that are listed here. just about anyone that's involved in ovarian cancer treatment or research has been part of AOCS. And so it's been really a wonderful effort to get all these people to cooperate. And I guess that's one of the messages I want to leave you with, is that there is, although there's some competition and there's some duplication in medical research, this is a wonderful example of how people can collaborate to do something that none of us could have done individually. And just to say that it can be very confusing to have OCA and AOCS and OCRF. We've had people who've been involved in AOCS say, "Oh, yes, you know, we left you, we made a very large donation to you, and it's ended up going to OCRF." So we're actually not related to OCRF in any way, and as far as I know, that program is for a program of research largely based at Monash, mainly around early detection, and is very distinct to what we do. So AOCS has been sort of interested in broadly in three things. We've been interested in understanding genetic risks. So what are the genes that we're born with that might increase the risk of developing ovarian cancer or other diseases? We're interested in environmental exposure. What are the things that in our diet or other environmental exposures might increase the risk of developing ovarian cancer? And we're interested in what makes the cancers tick. What drives their growth? What determines their response to therapy? And the arrows point between those three things because they're interrelated. So you could imagine, for example, that the genes that you have affect the type of cancer that develops, or that the environmental exposure affects the type of cancer that it develops. And that's true. As I'll show you in a little while, mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2 are associated with certain types of ovarian cancer. Smoking is associated with certain types of ovarian cancer. So really, we're trying to understand this sort of complex interaction between these three things. And our lab, my lab, is particularly interested in understanding the biology of the tumours. And the kinds of things that we're interested in is we want to know about the different types of ovarian cancer. And in a moment, I'm going to tell you that how important that is, that it turns out that this is absolutely not one disease. It's a whole collection of diseases that share an anatomical location in the body. We want to understand why treatment works and why it doesn't work, and why in, for the most common type, about 20 or 30% of women unexpectedly have a recurrence very soon after their treatment finishes. And we want to understand particularly what changes in a cancer that was originally sensitive to treatment that then allows it to come back and become resistant to treatment. What are the genetic changes that have happened in the cancer? And the things I'm going to tell you about are hard to follow, and I want to give you the first of these analogies. You know, how is it that we know things about DNA? How is it that we know what's happening to the genes in a cancer? And what's happened in science is similar to what's happened in fields, and the example here is in astronomy. So for, you know, back in, I guess, 200 years ago, using telescopes like this one, which I made actually, so I've got to get a picture of it in, you know, you could look through a telescope and you could see Mars, and you could see that there was a planet there, and you could see, you know, if on a good day you could see the polar caps, that little white spot at the bottom is the frozen ice and carbon dioxide, but you couldn't really see much else, right? But then the Mars Global Surveyor, which is this thing here, was launched. You know, where are we? This thing here was launched, and it flew around Mars, you know, some kilometres up in the air, and suddenly, instead of just seeing this round ball, you could see canyons down here, and you could see mountains and valleys and landform. And then finally the Spirit rover was developed, and that gave you resolution right down on the surface. So you could see grains of sand. You could see exquisite detail just like you were there. And the same thing has happened in cancer research. So for a long time we've been able to look down microscopes and see the chromosomes in the nucleus of cells. So these are, I'll explain this a bit more in a moment, but this is the information, the instruction set for how a cell grows and divides, and it's the instruction set to make a person from an egg all the way to us and to keep us alive. and it's packaged in these bundles, like bundles of wool, if you like, and these are the chromosomes. And we could see that in a cancer cell that there are sometimes too many of these and sometimes they are lost. And using a certain technique, we could see when pieces of them were missing or pieces of them were gained. But we couldn't, it's like being at, you know, out in the surface of, you know, with a telescope. You couldn't see any detail. You couldn't see what the code was. But then about 10 years ago, this technology was invented. And this is all the 22 chromosomes in a patient have been computationally spread out in a line. And what this graph shows is the numbers of copies of different parts of the code as you go from 1 to 22. And right on around chromosome 8, there are lots of copies of chromosome 8. And we thought that that might be because that the genes that were under that place were being required for the cancer cell, but we still couldn't kind of get down to the detail. And then just in the last 3 years, this machine has been invented, and that allows us now to look at right at the sequence level, right down to the base, right to the letter code of individual patients in real time. And I'll explain that a bit more in a moment. So the things I'm going to tell you about seem mysterious, but they're sort of like this. You start out with one technology, a telescope, and then you end up with something that orbits planets, and then you end up with the Spirit rover. Exactly the same thing has happened in biology. We've used the same sorts of technology drive to get closer and closer and closer to the problem. Okay, so the first of those four topics is ovarian cancer, and it isn't what we thought it was. And here's another analogy. So these are Scottish tartans, and I'm sure at a certain level we think that these are, you know, these are behind, they're all Scotsmen, right? But to a Forbes or a Fraser, they're very different, right? And you can see that in the patterns here. And the same thing happens when a pathologist looks at a tissue sample. So when a tissue sample is taken from surgery, it's sectioned and put onto a glass slab. So these are just tiny, tiny wafer-thin sections through the tissue sample. And then a whole lot of pathologists get together. They're a bit of a weird bunch of pathologists. They sort of, you know, spend all their time looking down these microscopes. And just like the tartans, you get different patterns. And the patterns tell you a great deal about the biology, the likely biology of the cancer. So when we talk about ovarian cancers, there are lots of different types of ovarian cancers. And I'm not going to tell you about all of them, but they break right away into two main groups: epithelial ovarian cancers, which are not from the cells that make the eggs, they're from other cells. And then there are germ cell ovarian cancers, and they're the ones associated with the eggs. But most ovarian cancers, the invasive ones, over 90% of them come from the non-egg cells, come from the epithelial cells. And of those, there are lots of different types, but the four most common type are here: mucinous, endometrioid, clear cell, and serous. Not serious, serous. And they're serious too, but they're serous. And this is a pie chart of how we used to think about the frequency of them. So over half of them are these serous ones in blue, and then the next most common one were these mucinous ones, and endometrioid, clear cell, and other, this sort of grab bag of lots of other things. And it's based essentially on this pattern, just like the tartans, okay? So that's what we thought. We thought that they arose from these cells. So these little dots, cells, this is a section through an ovary, so size of a big, sort of biggish walnut. Cut a section through it, stain it. And each of these dots is a cell. And a cell to an organ is the same as a brick to a wall. So in the way that a house is made of lots and lots of bricks and you end up with a house, lots and lots of cells, you end up with an ovary, or lots and lots of different sorts of cells, and you end up with a liver cell. And we're just looking at each of those bricks, each of those cells. And it was thought that that all these different types of ovarian cancer came from these cells on the surface of the ovary. And I guess the big surprise in the last couple of years, partly from our work and from work overseas, is that that turns out to be pretty much all wrong. So these four types of ovarian cancer are very different to each other, and they mostly don't come from the ovary. So endometrioid and clear cell cancers are associated with endometriosis. And endometriosis is from cells that come from the lining of the uterus, move up through the tubes and spread into the peritoneal space in some women for partly genetic reasons, and reside there. And in a minority of women with endometriosis, they can go on to develop clear cell and endometrioid cancer. And that's something that became very clear about 18 months ago in a study that we were part of in Canada. So those two are really cells that come from the uterus in the first place. These mucinous cancers turn out mostly to be cancers not of the ovary, but that have spread from the bowel or the stomach or the appendix to the ovary. And there are reasons why the ovary is a good site for these cells to actually spread, but they're actually really GI malignancies for the most part, we think, that have gone from the ovary. Probably not all of them, but many of them. And then these high-grade serous cancers, which... From the bowel. Oh, stomach, bowel, appendix, probably the most common sites. But not all of them. You'll see in the next slide there's a little wafer that we still think somehow might be associated with the ovary, but most of those seem to be from other sites. And then these high-grade serous cancers, it's sort of the big thing at the moment is that our belief that many of those probably come from the fallopian tubes, not from the ovary. And the fallopian tube is like a catcher's mitt. So here's the ovary, and an egg's released, and there's this sort of catcher's mitt to grab it, take it down the tubes for it to be fertilised. And they're very close together, and we think that the cells at the end of the fallopian tube are probably accounting for maybe the majority of these serous cancers. It's still debated somewhat. It's still not sorted out, but that seems to be the take. So not only are a lot of these things not coming from the ovary, they're actually very, very different to each other. And the way they behave is very different to each other, and I'll show you an example of how that's important. So this is a young woman who was diagnosed when she was 33. She's still alive. She lives up in Sydney. And this is a plot of her CA125, and I think a lot of you all know what CA125s are. Sick of CA125s. And so when she had surgery, her CA125 was about 700, went down very rapidly because much of the tumour had been removed by the surgery. This is months across the bottom here. She had her chemotherapy here, platinum and Taxol, which is standard of care for ovarian cancer. It's ovarian cancer. It should be treated with platinum and Taxol. We know that only about 15% of clear cell cancers respond to platinum Taxol, but it's what's used at the moment. Almost as soon as the chemotherapy finished, and probably mostly as an effect of the surgery, mostly her remission here was probably mainly from the surgery, because almost as soon as the chemo finished, her CA125 started to rise. Started to go up. She was treated with another drug here called letrozole, and it went straight through that. The second one was letrozole, and it went straight through that. And then she was treated with Calix here. And you can see that she had a small dip, but it came back. And she was very, very unwell, this woman. She had a lot of lymph node involvement and a lot of pain associated with that. And then she was lucky enough to be treated as part of a clinical trial with a drug called sunitinib. And sunitinib is a class of new drugs that is based on the biology. So you go out, you find the genes that you think are important, you make drugs to those, and then you give patients who have that particular target drug. She happened to be lucky to be enrolled onto this study, and you can see her CA125 without any surgery fell dramatically. It rebounded then, because the protocol was 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So it rebounded. So it was obvious that the drug was having a major effect. Went down again when she went back on, rebounded again, when she had the next 2 weeks in break, and then it went down, and it stayed down for nearly 2 years while she was on continuous sedentinib. And so she had a really remarkable response to this. And the important point about this is that sedentinib is a drug that's actually used in kidney cancer, and it's very active. And what we've just shown, and this is a figure from our paper, is that these ovarian clear cell cancers are molecularly very similar to renal cancers. They don't look like any of the other ovarian cancers. They actually look like kidney cancer. And it's no surprise in this sense that this drug, because of the biology of these tumours, would be active in this patient. And then there was a second patient who was also treated who also had a very good response, but then had side effects associated with the sedentinib, came off, and she progressed, and unfortunately she died. And there's now a clinical trial of sedentinib in clear cell cancer in the United States. And so this is a good example of why you've got to get it right, and why it's been so important to recognise that it's not one disease, but it's actually many diseases, and that you've got to treat it specifically for the type of disease that it is, and draw on the experience that we're gaining from other cancers to inform it. So this is why the reclassification is important. If I leave you with no other message today, is that it's just not, we're past the point where it should be one size fits all. It's really clear that we need clinical trials that are specific. They're starting to change now. So that's exactly right. So the reason that platinum Taxol is so dominant is that blue group, because they're exquisitely sensitive to it. And because until recently we've thought of it as a single disease, it's driven its use in these other areas. These other people have ovarian cancer. Platinum works great in ovarian cancer. We'll give it to them, even though the subsets don't necessarily have a good response to it. So what now is happening is that there are clinical trials of these subsets. So there's a trial for mucinous cancer being developed, or I think underway, for a drug regime that is more like what we use in bowel cancer. And we're trying to get a trial off the ground. The difficulty is with the companies of pazopanib, which is a similar drug to sunitinib in clear cell cancers. But there has to be, they are tested, but what we've got to do is change practice. And the way that we need to do that is to create type-specific clinical trials, and that's the phase that we're trying to get across the line now. And it's hard. You know, we definitely should have a pazopanib trial in clear cell cancers, and the barrier there is actually the companies and getting the companies to get engaged in that.
Is serous cancer, is it clear cell cancer?
No, it's different. Yep. This is mucinous.
No, I'm talking about just the big pie.
Yes. This one here. So that they're all serous.
Yeah.
So about 60%.
Yeah.
And then there's this group here that are also serous. And I didn't want to get into the complexity of this, but they're a different type of serous. And again, our work has shown that they are called serous cancers, but they are different. They have a different biology to them, and they need probably also different treatments.
Are
so,
they all epithelial?
Yep, all epithelial. Yep.
They say high-grade serous.
Low-grade? Yeah, so the one my arrow's on are low-grade serous. The ones that my arrow is pointing to, the light blue ones, they're the low-grade serous.
Is there a
medium
grade?
Yeah, but they're high-grade. So they go grade 1. Grade 1 is low, grade 2 is intermediate, and grade 3 is high. Grade 2 and 3 are the same.
When you read your pathology, it says medium or high. So
yes.
When you read the pathology, medium or high, we're talking about what we're calling high there.
Yeah, almost certainly. grade is actually a quality that the pathologist scores when they look down the scope, and it's a bit like saying how dishevelled is someone, you know, how dirty are they? Well, you know, that person's really dirty or that person's really tidy. It's kind of a subjective, partly subjective thing, and that's why grade twos are sort of, you know, can't really tell if it's in between sometimes. They generally are grade threes though. What we need to do is to talk about the biology of them. And so high-grade serous is shorthand for the actual molecular biology that we now understand about these tumours. And their biology is actually quite different to low-grade tumours. And we'd be far better off to talk about the biology because that takes us to the drugs. So not one size doesn't fit all. The genetic risks actually track with the subtypes. So when we talk about the risks that someone carries one of these germline mutations, we can assess that risk much more accurately if we talk about these, whether it's high-grade serous or low-grade serous. For example, you just don't see BRCA mutations in clear cell cases, except where they're misdiagnosed high-grade serous cancers, as we've discovered. So it's very important in terms of understanding genetic risk. We can't figure out the biology if we sort of treat it as one thing. I mean, the analogy I've used, which is sort of a slightly odd one, is that it's a bit like trying to describe fruit by describing a bowl of apples and oranges and pears and bananas. And if you treat it as all of, as fruit, you never get a consistent answer. You can't. Sometimes it's yellow, sometimes it's orange, sometimes it's spiky. Until you sort of separate them into their piles, these are the oranges, these are the bananas, you can't say, okay, well, that's what makes that tick, right? And so a very big part of what we've been doing is separate them out. And it keeps going. So it turns out, I won't be talking about this, but the high-grade serous, actually, we've identified four types of high-grade serous that are different in terms of their behaviour, and there are probably more than that. It can be. They're the ones that are, like, in the middle. Yes. Yep. And knowing where they come from influences our ideas about early detection and prevention. So if they're coming from the fallopian tube, someone has a hysterectomy, make sure that the fallopian tubes are taken out, for example. So it reduces the risk of ovarian cancer, and we haven't really understood why that would be the case. And it could be either that you're removing some of the fallopian tube, and it depends on how the tubal ligation's done. Often when they were done with the view that they could be reversed if need be. So often they were just a ligation rather than a removal. But it also could be that by ligating it, it affects the ability of carcinogens to target those cells. So it might be that acts as a barrier. Not really sure. So genetic risk, much clearer picture now. So we're going to have to talk a bit about genes, and people always get lost when you talk about genes. And so again, some pictures here to make it kind of a bit easier. So the thing that looks like a hot dog there is actually a bacteria that causes traveller's diarrhoea, you know, E. coli and so on. And what has happened here is that to put it bluntly, the thing's been squashed. And this stuff that looks like string that's coming out of it is actually the DNA. This is just a bacteria, and you can see there's a lot of this stuff. And it's basically, any of you ever use a telex, you know, where you sort of fed that punch card through a telex and it turned it into type? That's essentially what this is like. It's like a code, basically, and the cell uses it and reads it, and it reads it as an instruction set. So it's a real thing. DNA is not just some kind of abstract notion that we've come up with. You can find it just by squishing a bacteria and looking at it with a powerful microscope. We're much more complex than a bacteria, so we need a lot more code. And, you know, you can't leave this stuff lying around because it'll just get tangled up in the cell. So it gets packaged. So it's like balls of wool. Think of chromosomes like balls of wool. And we have 22 pairs, and then there's an X and a Y. And, you know, they're numbered just sequentially by how big they are. So chromosome 1 is the biggest one, and then they go all the way through to 22, which is small. And one has lots of genes on it and 22 has a few, basically, is how it works. And it's a code. So we talk about this code of AGTC. It isn't actually written AGTC, but they're the abbreviations of the chemical letters of the code that the cell uses when it's reading it, like reading an alphabet. And so here's another analogy. So who knows what this is? Okay, so there's some people in the audience. So always good to show this slide. It's a really sort of demographic test, because if the audience is under, you know, 40 or something like that, everyone goes, no, I don't know what that is. It's a real dying art. So obviously this is a code for making this. So making one of these. And why is it that women are not adoring of men like this anymore? I don't know why it doesn't happen. Yeah, I guess so. It's certainly a bit dated, isn't it? So yeah, that's a code for making one of those. And so this is a bit of code for making the thing that's wearing the jumper. So to a biologist, in the same way that some of you can read that and turn that into information that you can then turn... A biologist like me can read that code, especially if I'm using a computer, and turn that into information. And so it's been annotated. There are things here that say start and end, and you know, we can read now using computers, we can translate millions of these bases almost instantaneously into code. And so the way that it works is that a gene is enough of that code to make a protein. And a protein is a thing. It's like a little tiny person. And, you know, like our hair is made of lots of keratin. And that's a type of protein, and it has a particular behavior, and that's why it's good for making hair. And the keratin gene is enough information to tell the cell, go and make keratin. And so that's what a gene is. And the DNA is just code, and it's written in these letters, and biologists can figure this stuff out now using computers, and we can get right down on the surface using those clever boxes like I was telling you about. And the reason that it's been so difficult to figure this out, to really make progress on cancer, is that cancer is basically a problem with this code being corrupted. And there is an unbelievable amount of it in us. And so this is a poster from the Sanger Centre where in the UK, in Hinxton, in the UK, near Cambridge. And they were one of the main centres that first figured out the first human sequence. And the poster is in 8-point font, and it's about 7 or 8 metres high and 1 metre wide, and it's part of the code for a human. Except that you need 2,000 of these to write down just one of us. And if you, you know, do the maths on that, if you covered the ground of the MCG in 8-point font, that's our sequence. So, you know, that's a lot of information to figure out. And we all have the same basic sequence, but there's variation. Maybe every 1,000 bases, every 1,000 letters, there'll be a difference between, you know, you and I. And that's what makes us different. And it's those, you know, if you're looking for a mutation in a gene that increases the risk of cancer, you've got to find that one letter in 8-point font on the floor of the MCG. And that's why it's been so hard to figure this out. And that's just finding one gene. We've got about 20,000 genes. They actually make a lot more proteins than that because some clever ways that the information is used by the cell. And, you know, we have to understand how all this stuff is working together. So it's a really, it's easily the toughest problem that humans have ever faced in terms of understanding something, in terms of its complexity. And because cancer's a problem of this code, until you understand the code, until you can read it, until you can manipulate it, it's very hard to make progress on it. So to keep the analogy going, if you think about it as code, this laptop has a code. It tells the laptop, when you open the lid, how to fire up the operating system, how to wake up, how when you click on Word, boot up Word, how to do stuff with word processing, when you move the mouse around. All that is in the operating system of this computer, and it's all written in silicon. Our code is just written in DNA, and it's in the nucleus. And just as in computers, people can be born with either a great operating system like a Mac, you know, obviously a Mac user, or not such a great operating system like a Windows. Right. So, and so that's what happens here. So this is an example. It's a bit gory, I'm sorry. This is a person that has inherited bowel cancer, and they have just one error in that code of a gene that's important in the bowel, and each of these little pimples here in the bowel is the start of a cancer. And it's actually a protein that is there to fix damages to the DNA. So we walk out in the sun, I was walking down here today, DNA will be damaged by the UV light. Cells are very clever, they recognise that, fix it, repair it, and goes on. In the bowel, there are carcinogens going through, damage the DNA in the cells. Normal person, that process is fixed. In this person, there's a defect in the machine that fixes the DNA. And so each of these little pimples is the start of a cancer caused by that damage. And here's a pedigree from three generations. It's very insulting, I think. The round ones are always female and the square ones are male. So black circle means that the individuals had that disease, uterine cancer at 68, breast cancer, breast cancer, breast cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer at these ages. And so you can see that tracking through this family is a mutation in a gene that is increasing the risk of that person developing breast or ovarian cancer, and this is in BRCA1 or BRCA2. So the inherited genes like this can be either these really very strongly acting mutations, or for many of us, many of you here, it's more like this. We think the effect of lots of little genes. Lots of, not little genes, but genes that have a little effect that might increase your risk of developing ovarian cancer by 50%. You know, not much. It sounds like a lot, but compared to these BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, they increase your risk by 10 or 20 times. Okay, this maybe increases your risk a little bit. And so if you happen to carry a 2, let's call it, then that increases your risk. And if that happens, and you also happen to carry on another gene, a 3, and another one on another gene, a 3, you know, and not such a great bit of this and a not such great bit of that, collectively, together with maybe environmental influence, that can add up to a cancer. And so, you know, and this is probably the story for most of us, probably me too, in terms of my family, that, you know, you hope that we're probably, many of us are carrying these different combinations. And every time a baby is created, it's like two packs of cards have been shuffled from mum and dad, and the genes have been sort of shuffled up, and then another, you know, pack of 20,000 has been, you know, passed out, and that's a different combination. And so sometimes the combination comes together, like the not so good ones, and then after a generation or two it might break apart again, and then that person, the next generation, might be less at risk. So there are, the way we're thinking about this now is that there are genes that increase the risk a lot. They tend to track in families, not always, and then probably for many people it's more a combination of things that are having a small effect and adding up, coming together, going apart down the generations like this. Yeah, so can I answer that in a second?
Yep.
Because I'm just about to come to that. So now we come to these two genes. So this is these are genes that were first identified in breast cancer, so that's where they get their names from. But they also increase the risk of developing ovarian cancer. These are normal genes. We all have BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. The problem is if they get damaged. And so we're really talking about inheritance of a damaged version of one of these genes. And so they can increase the risk, as I said, 10 to 20%. You know, if you think about a watch, right, it's got cogs and springs and hands and all that sort of thing. Repairing DNA in a cell requires the same sort of machine. There are different proteins that come together and they have to do different things to sense the damage and fix it. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are part of that machine. They're a very important part of it. And when they're damaged, the machine gets damaged. And so they increase the risk of breast and ovarian cancer. Their frequency has been thought to be from 5 to 18%. And the testing tends to be, at the moment, is based on a strong family history. So if a person comes along and says, my mother had ovarian cancer, my auntie had ovarian cancer, and her sister had breast cancer under 50, then they would be assessed and they'd say, well, you know, your risk of carrying one of these genes is high, we can offer you testing. So what we wanted to do was we really wanted to understand the frequency of these mutations and see whether they influenced the way the woman was treated or should be treated, and whether the guidelines for genetic testing should be changed, and whether they were associated with particular types of ovarian cancer. So to try and answer your question about, you know, really which ones do we need to think about for this. And this is a study this is the one that's just going to come out in a couple of weeks, so you're sort of getting it even hotter than hot off the press. And it basically could only be done really using AOCS. No one else was really in a position to do it. So all the patients came in at the top, and then there were various inclusion and exclusion criteria, and then we tested, it turned out to be 1,001 women for these mutations. And this is what we found. So it turns out that just over 20% of high-grade serous cancers carry these mutations. About half the women that carried the mutations had a family history. The other half didn't. So that's an important thing to know.
Any family history?
A relevant family history, so breast or ovarian cancer.
Or prostate?
We mainly had data. Yeah, prostate was included, but our data for that wasn't as complete. So it's about 40, a little over 40% of them didn't have a clear family history. At least a family history that would be sufficient to say you need to be tested, which I guess is operationally the most important thing. If you went back and looked at those 40% really carefully and you went and got more data from them, you might see something in them then. But at least at the level of the analysis for a clinician to say, gee, I think you should go and consider being tested, a little under half of them didn't have enough of a history. It was almost always in the high-grade serous cancers. And the reason I say almost is that there were a couple of patients that had clear cell and endometrioid cancers, but then we went and looked at those cancers very, very carefully, and they turned out almost certainly to be misdiagnosed high-grade serous cancers. And it has to do with the sort of the error in pathology at the moment. It's not completely precise. And so sometimes they can be misdiagnosed, rarely, but it can be. So it's a little bit dangerous for us to say it's only the high-grade serous cancers. If it was in a patient with clear cell cancer, very unlikely to be carrying a mutation, but we can't rule it out completely. Did it influence treatment? It actually does a lot. I mean, the downside of having one of these mutations is that it increases your risk of developing ovarian cancer. The upside is that patients respond better to treatment and they have a better survival profile that they're carrying these mutations. And they respond to platinum, and they keep responding to platinum in general, not always, but in general. And so I don't have time to go into the details, but the way that we think about deciding to shift women from platinum to another drug needs to change for women who are carriers. We really need to persist and be absolutely sure that they're not responding to platinum. Yep. Yeah, by platinum I mean carboplatin, cisplatin, sometimes oxaliplatin, but mostly carboplatin. Carboplatin is the most common one. So platinum is sort of general for platinums. So you've got to persist with platinum. And should the genetic guidelines testing change? Yeah, I mean, basically, when a geneticist sits in front of someone who they think might carry a risk of a genetic disease, cystic fibrosis, you know, whatever, you know, BRCA1 or BRCA2, any sort of a rule of thumb is if it's about 10% chance that they may be carrying one of those mutations, they should be offered genetic testing. For anyone who has high-grade serous cancer, that should be enough for them to be offered testing. And is it useful to know? I mean, this is the scary part of it, and I can certainly relate to this.
If you've already got a high grade serous cancer, what's the point of being tested? Because they know because you've got it.
Two things. One is that we need to rethink how the treatment. We need to persist with platinum rather than shift. We had patients who had recurrence within 6 months of the end of their chemotherapy that were carrying a mutation. That would be a criteria to shift them to another treatment. For odd reasons, they were treated with platinum. 90% of them responded to platinum in a second-line setting. If you carry one of these mutations, you have to be absolutely sure that they're not going to respond to platinum before you shift them to something else, because they respond better to platinum than they do to other things.
And the other thing is
breast monitoring. And although in our study there were no women who developed breast cancer in the 2 or 3 years after their ovarian cancer diagnosis, which sort of makes sense because the actual risk per year is fairly low, and so you don't need to get onto it right away, probably, from that point of view. But where it's very important is for sisters and daughters, brothers, because it increases the risk of prostate cancer. And it's not what we would want, because, you know, in terms of prevention, but removal of the fallopian tubes in the ovaries cuts the risk of developing ovarian cancer by between 80 to 90%. It's obviously not something to be taken lightly, but the alternative being ovarian cancer, this is a very feasible risk-reducing strategy, particularly for women who are perimenopausal, who've had their children. It's definitely something to think about because it can reduce the risk enormously. Yes. If they carry one of these mutations. So the guidelines for what to do around BRCA testing and monitoring it and what to do for reducing risk in males are not well worked out yet. But for women, for ovarian cancer, we know that the risk can be reduced substantially. One of the debates at the moment is, should we remove the ovaries or could we just get away with the fallopian tubes? And particularly in women who are premenopausal, that's actually something to really think about. We don't have the evidence for that at the moment, and so we don't want to just sort of jump to that because it's still somewhat debated, but it's an area. This is where figuring out where things come from actually have real life significance, because if it comes from the fallopian tubes and we know that it's a risk, and it's all in, it's the tumours that come from fallopian tubes that have these mutations or can have these mutations, then that can translate through to some practical stuff. So what's being discussed at the moment is maybe a woman might consider having her fallopian tubes removed premenopausally, and when she starts to go through menopause, then have her ovaries removed as well. They're the kind of things we're thinking about. We need to keep going. So other genes, this is an incredibly active area of research, and ASCS has been really very important to contributing to an international consortium called OCAC. So we were one of the founders of OCAC, and it's been sort of producing these sort of studies of looking really carefully for other genes. And we've found the biggies, like BRCA1 and BRCA2, and we're now trying to find these threes and fours in the pack. Not the joker, you know, these really tough ones. HMPCC is related to brown cancer. Leaf Rhalmini is related to a lot of different types of cancers. And then there are these low-risk genes that are starting to come through. We don't really know how to handle this information at the moment in terms of risk management, but the first step is to find the genes and then to figure it out from there. Early detection, we've got to keep going, why this is a tough problem. First of all, it's really important to say that this isn't like we've been lazy and no one's really tried to do anything about developing an early detection test. This is a study that was published late last year, a very high profile study from the US called the PLCO study, and they screened 78,000 women using CA125 and ultrasound in a proportion of them, I think, to try and detect the cancer early and improve outcomes. And there was more time, I could tell you a lot more about this, but whenever you are listening to something about early detection, the key question to ask is, does the screened population do better? Forget about how many cancers are detected, whether they're early, whether they're late, or anything like that. Bottom line, does the screened population do better? Because if the early detection test is worth anything, then more people who are screened will be alive than the people who are not screened. And what the study found was that there was no survival benefit from that regime for ovarian cancer. It's not what you want to hear. You want to hear that there's an early... We all want to hear that there's an early detection test, but we need to know the answer here, because we need to know whether it's safe to screen someone or whether we've got to take more drastic measures. There's no point in sort of thinking that screening is fine when it's not, you know. We actually need to know the truth. So that was the PLCO study. And then this is a study that Ian Jacobs, who spent the last 20 years... Very young-looking guy. Hard to imagine that he spent 20 years on this. And Usha Menon, at University College London have led, and this is it's cost about £35 million, I think. It's been running for, the study took a while to design, I think it's been running for over 10 years. 20,000 women enrolled, CA125 and ultrasound. And that will be reported on in about another 18 months, but the expectation is that there probably won't be a screen benefit there either. So, why is it so tough? It's heterogeneous. You're comfortable, I think, now with that idea. So a single test is not likely to work. It's uncommon. And so this gets a bit technical, but false positives are a real problem. You've got 10,000 women at the MCG. Three of them have ovarian cancer and they don't know it. That's the incidence of ovarian cancer, three or four of them, right? Come along with a test. 99 times out of 100, the test is accurate. Right, it's right. One times out of 100, it gets it wrong. You've got the 10,000 women, apply the test, 100 positives, three of them are real. It's an uncommon disease. That's what makes it so difficult is that you've got to then put 100 women through the ringer to figure out those four before you even have shown that the four are going to do better. It makes it really difficult. Anatomy works against us. Ovary, fallopian tube, and then you've got all the rest of the abdomen. In a bowel cancer, you get this polyp that grows, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it's got to punch through the wall of the bowel. In an ovary cancer, it just sheds off the surface from the fallopian tube or from the ovary and then just drifts through the abdomen because it's all one space. And so it's very hard to get it before it spreads. Whereas with a bowel cancer, it takes about 5 years to go from that polyp through to something that can punch through. Probably much shorter with ovary. And there's nothing to stop it. It just sort of sheds off. So that means that there's almost no window of opportunity to see it before it, when it's there and you can recognize it, before it's spread. And it's deep inside. I mean, you know, pap smear is not great, I believe. And I know colorectal... You know, having a colonoscopy is not great, but it's, in a sense, it's accessible. Whereas, you know, you actually need to make a hole in order to look at someone's fallopian tubes or ovaries. So it makes it a really, really tough problem. And if you think about it, early detection, everyone has wanted early detection for cancer. There are two early detection tests in cancer that are worth anything, really, that are really good. Cervical cancer screening, fantastic, incredibly successful. Bowel cancer screening, national disgrace that we don't have a good bowel cancer screening program. Mammography, okay, maybe. And the rest after that, a question mark. And it has, you can't wish this stuff. You've got to know the biology and know what you're up against. And that's why an early detection test is so difficult. But we keep trying. So here I am, suited up. There, this is... may or may not pick it up. What we know from women who are carriers and we're watching very carefully is that it doesn't improve outcomes in high-risk women. So if you're watching these women particularly carefully and you haven't improved their survival by doing ultrasound and CA125, that's telling you something. And it has to do with the fact that it can be tiny, tiny little thing in the fallopian tube and spread. The question is whether detecting it when there's what they call low volume disease, not like lots of tumour, it might have spread through the abdomen, but it still might be tiny, whether those people do better. And that's what the UK study is going to try and answer. Sorry, there was a question there? Right. It's really important to know, because you just don't want high-risk women saying, well, look, I'm being screened and I know I'm carrying the mutation, but I'm being screened and I'll be fine, I'll be picked up early. You've got to... Medicine these days is about truth. Even if the truth is, you know, for us as researchers, or particularly for us as patients, is hard to know, we have to know the truth. And it can't be about sort of wishing... It can't be the triumph of hope over reason. Do you know what I mean? So anyway, as I said, you can never say never, and it's such an important question that we should try and do it. And so the Rivkin Foundation in the US had this international competition for what they call the Challenge Grant, their first ever Challenge Grant. And I wrote this grant basically telling them why I didn't think that, you know, the conventional approaches to early detection would work, and there was really only one way, and it was very difficult. And basically it was more a kind of a commentary rather than a grant. Anyway, they gave me the grant. And so we're now working on this, and it's a different strategy. It's to look for circulating mutations in a gene called P53 that occur in all the high-grade serous cancers. This is something else we just showed recently, and it occurs very early. So it's the perfect biomarker. It occurs early in the disease. It occurs in all of them. And we think, using some of this new sequencing technology, that we might be able to look for circulating copies of this in the blood that are being released from very early cancers.
It means
a blood test. And I personally, it's a long shot. It really is. But where it would be neat is that it actually could be a test for other types of cancers, because this gene gets mutated in other cancers. I'm a bit conscious of the time. So... And I'm sure not everyone feels that way. My wife doesn't. So, where does that leave us, basically? I think, strategically, we've got to identify people who are at genetic risk and prevent it as best we can. At the moment, what we have is crude, but that'll get better. Or we've got to figure out better therapies for the people that have got it. And that's not to keep people like me in business, but the reality is that women are going to come through the door next year with ovarian cancer, and we need to be able to figure out how to cure that and get much better results. Okay, so I didn't completely answer that question. You've got to rephrase the question. What percentage of high-grade serous cancers are genetic? Probably about 26-28%, because there's some other genes I didn't mention. What proportion of clear cell cancers are genetic? We don't know any genes at the moment that are associated with clear cell cancers. They're probably associated with endometriosis. What proportion of low-grade endometrioid cancers are genetic? Maybe none, and they're cured surgically. You have to refine the question. You can't... It's like saying, what proportion of Australians are nice? You know, general answers are not helpful. You have to say, for a particular group, what's the risk that person carries a mutation? You know what I mean? You can't treat it simplistically. So, and we've got to think of better therapies. And so that's the last bit that I want to kind of run through. New therapies. Why does chemotherapy work? Anyone here's opportunity for more audience participation. Why does chemotherapy work? Yeah, it kills the cells. Why does it kill them and not us? I mean, most people say it kills cells because they're dividing, and that's partially true, but lots of cells are dividing in us. You know, we make it... It does. Yeah, it's true, but it's not just that. In fact, it's mostly not that. And it has to do with this. So here are some cells. It's under a microscope. There's one that's just divided, This is sped up, by the way. They don't go this fast, thank goodness. They'll go around, I think the movie loops. There. One becomes two, two become four. And you're all molecular biologists now. You know that this is the nucleus and all the DNA is stuffed in there. Can't see it at this level of resolution, but get a bigger microscope and you can see it down to the basis, right? So cells do this all the time. We make 1 billion blood cells a day, you know. And this is a little bit technical, but they go around a cycle. And the cycle makes sense. They have to make DNA. They've got to make another set of DNA. They pause, and then they divide into the two cells. So M stands for mitosis. That's a Latin name for splitting. And S stands for synthesis. That's when the DNA is made. And this is an incredibly intricate process. I mean, you've got no idea just how clever this is. And it's a very, very, very simple diagram that's there. And at each of the red arrows, the cells have machinery that checks that things are right before it goes on to the next step. And so the best way to think about these checkpoints is like checking your shoelaces are done up before you go out to play. And what happens in a cancer cell is that it has to ignore those checkpoints because its DNA is damaged, and in a normal cell that would stop, it would stop doing what it was doing, and it would either kill itself because it was so damaged, or it would stop and repair it. In a cancer cell it can't do that. It has to ignore that, otherwise it can't be a cancer cell, because if it didn't ignore it, it'd just stop, and then it wouldn't be a cancer. So a cancer cell has lost all these checkpoints, and chemotherapy, in one form or another, is taking advantage of the things that allow it to be a cancer, and one of them is these checkpoint things. So lots of cells have lost their checkpoint control, so think of them as getting around with their shoelaces undone, and we've got to figure out how to trip them up, basically. And so when you come along with platinum and you damage the DNA, what happens in a normal cell, there's this very clever machinery, says the DNA has been damaged, it stops, it fixes the damage, and it starts again. Sometimes it actually doesn't stop and fix it. It stops and says, I'm too damaged, I'm actually going to die. And that's why your hair falls out. You get a break in the growth of the hair. Or that's why, you know, you end up with GI symptoms and so on, because the cells actually, it's, you know, in sunburn, it's not that you've actually been burnt. What's happened is that the DNA has been so damaged, the cells said, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm dying. That way I won't become a cancer cell in the future. And so you get a break in the skin and, you know, it peels off. And so that's what happens in a normal cell. It's very sensible. It either fixes itself, kills itself, life goes on, sort of thing. Not for it, but for the other cells around it. In a cancer cell, it either doesn't sense that the damage has occurred or it ignores it. And we've caused so much damage that it keeps going through the cycle and there's a catastrophe. All those chromosomes shatter and the cell just can't survive. And that's why it's killed. Okay. So a lot of our work on chemotherapy is figuring out those untangled shoelaces, taking advantage of what it means to be a cancer cell. So you'll hear about this drug, this class of drug, the PARP inhibitors, if you haven't heard of it already. And an example is a drug called olaparib. They have funny names that are hard to pronounce for everyone, but anyway. And this targets those high-grade serous cancers, and it takes advantage of a failure of DNA damage that caused the cancer in the first place, makes them sensitive to platinum. And there's a very clever sort of trick. What happens in these cells is that they've lost a way of damaging, of repairing their DNA, and they're sort of running on a backup system, and olaparib targets the backup system. And so the normal cells have the normal process and the backup system. You take out the backup system, they don't care, and so the rest of the patient is fine, but the cancer cell has lost the normal system, you hit the backup system, and now it's really in trouble, and it dies. So PARP stands for poly-ADP ribose polymerase. And it's an enzyme that's involved in the backup DNA repair process. And so the inhibitor inhibits that enzyme and kills this backup process of DNA repair. And the cleverness is that it targets specifically the cancer, as I said, because the normal cell has the normal process. And if the backup process is lost, it still is okay. So the PARP... No, the cancers that have got defects in the BRCA pathway.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So at the moment, we're trying to figure out how best to use this. And so there are clinical trials that have shown really very substantial benefit, including patients who are resistant to chemotherapy. The chance of responding is reduced if they're resistant to chemotherapy, but women who have been resistant to platinum-based therapy have had some very good responses to olaparib. Part of the problem is we can't predict it really well. We know carriers respond better than non-carriers, but some non-carriers also respond. And so the trials are trying to figure out who are best to get these drugs. For high-grade serous cancers, these are easily the most impressive and interesting drugs at the moment, and they're just at the beginning. The PARP inhibitors, yeah, very, very interesting work. Not yet, but we're hoping that there'll be another PARP inhibitor trial. There's one getting underway for breast, and we're hoping that there'll be a PARP trial for ovary sometime this year. I should say that Australians, not our lab, but Claire Scott, Gillian Mitchell, members of ANSCOG, have been amongst world leaders in the development of the PARP inhibitors. They've been very actively involved. So Australia's actually very well integrated into the PARP trials. Yes and no. I mean, they are very precise. They're these magic bullet type approach. So platinum damages DNA. That's what it does. It causes interstrand cross-links and damages the DNA. The PARP inhibitors go to just a protein. They're not damaging the DNA, and they're damaging the ability to repair damage. So it's actually a tablet, and the side effects are much less than the side effects associated with platinum. Yeah. So this is where we want to go with these molecularly targeted therapies. In fact, that's the next slide. So this is sort of... there's a lot of hype about this, but basically it is where we have to go with cancer therapies. That's actually a wiring diagram of a cell. You know, like I was saying, incredibly complex. People like me have been figuring out the biology. You find the key targets, you make the drug. It's, you know, the target is a needle in the haystack, the base and, you know, the MCG. You go through all the process with drug companies of making the drugs, and then you give it to the people. That's a 40-year paradigm. It started when Richard Nixon declared war on cancer, and it works. We haven't solved cancer yet, but this is what will ultimately solve cancer. The PARP inhibitors are a good example of this. They figured out this was the way to hit the shoelace that was untied. They made a drug, gave it to people, and it worked. Not always predictable. They developed resistance, but it's an example of that paradigm. And so here's another good example. Herceptin in breast cancer. What's staining here are the breast cancer cells. We're using a special dyeing technique that shows that this thing here, which is a protein sitting on the surface of the cell, this funny looking thing, is actually the bag that the cell sits in, and it's bristling with these proteins on the surface that communicate information from outside the cell and into the nucleus. And there are too many of these in some breast cancers, about 30% of breast cancers. And they send a go signal when they shouldn't. And Herceptin is an antibody that blocks this process. And so this is an example of that paradigm. Here's a target in breast cancer, make a drug that's, in this case, it's an antibody, give it to people and it works. Again, not perfectly, but it's a definite improvement. And so another example of this that some of you might have come across are the VEGF inhibitors. And they, again, have odd names like bevacizumab. And that's an antibody to a hormone that the cancer cell makes to make blood vessels. And so as the cancer's growing, it needs a blood supply. And so the bevacizumab trials have been the other really big thing in ovary in terms of trials. And so you might have heard of ICON-7 or GOG-218 or OCEANS. These were very large international clinical trials that Australia participated in as well. And they were trialling bevacizumab in conjunction with chemotherapy. And basically, they were used during and after chemotherapy. The best results were in patients who stayed on it. There's a recurrence after the treatment ceases. The blood vessels sort of spring back to life. The moment there are concerns about the length of remission, it's not long enough, and we can't really identify patients who are most likely to benefit. You'd think all the tumours need to make blood vessels, everyone's going to benefit, but it doesn't work like that. We don't know yet why some people respond well and others don't. And unfortunately, cost is an issue in terms of registration. A course of bevacizumab is of the order of $90,000. Now, that's not, you know, that's versus a human life, $90,000, I'll take the human life. But the problem is that the length of remission is short, and health authorities weigh these things up. If it's going to be 3 months versus $90,000, can we afford it? And it affects registration of these drugs, and it slows the process down. And that's why being able to identify those that are most likely to respond changes it. So instead of maybe 10% of people might benefit, if you could say 100% of people are going to benefit, then the equations change and people might then pull it through to standard care. So last slide, where do we go next? So this is sort of basically a summary. Ovarian cancer is not what we thought it was. Need to separate it out, need to treat it separately. The genetics is clearer. I hope I've answered your question about risk, but you should all be informed now. Okay, so where do we go? Everyone in this room now should get the fact that this isn't one disease. It's many diseases. You've got to know which one it is. Then you can ask questions about what's the best treatment for that type. That's evolving fast now for more specific treatments. Don't leave here thinking that you've not been treated in the right way or it's probably all up in the air. That's not the case. But we have to refine it, and we have to refine it based on these sorts of experiments. You know, people who do this stuff are very hooked into it now, and we'll want to change these things as fast as we can. It's just the nature of research that it takes time to figure these things out. The genetics is clear, and the genetics is related to type, right? We're now starting to get a complete blueprint of how these things work, like their wiring diagram. And it has to be like a diffusing a bomb, you know, cut the red wire, not the blue wire, you know, figure out the wiring diagram, step in there with a PARP inhibitor or a cyclin E inhibitor or whatever, and do it. And then the big thing for our lab is what I call the whack-a-mole problem. So if any of you have taken kids or grandkids down to Swanson Street and they have these things where, you know, you belt the mole and then it pops up somewhere else and you've got to belt that. You know, that's where we're at the moment too much in cancer. We have to get ahead of the game. We have to anticipate where the mole's going to pop up before it pops up, so we're ready to belt it or actually drive treatment back into that first line setting, anticipating how it would fail if we didn't do that, and change the way we need to treat people in the first line setting. So a big focus for our lab is very much about what happens when it comes back. What's changed? Why is it different now to what it was in the beginning? If we can understand that, drive that back into primary care. That's where we're going. I'm running out of voice. Happy to answer any other questions.
You mentioned at one point a link between smoking and ovarian cancer. Did you explain, is it serous cancer? Or
mucinous, mainly.
Sorry?
Mucinous cancer.
Not serous.
Not so much serous. Yes. Yes. Is there a risk? Look, I think the short answer. So the question is, I have to repeat the questions for the mic here. Apparently, the question is, if you've had uterus and tubes, and one partial oophorectomy, one ovary remaining, what's the risk? The short answer is, there wouldn't be data on that. I would think the risk would be reduced. Would the risk be zero? I doubt it.
Yeah.
Aware of that. Yep. Yeah, I was asked about that earlier. No. Yeah, not directly. As far as I am aware, I'm not aware of any aspirin trials. Should you take aspirin, you know, as a matter of course? I don't think there's any data on that at the moment. Aspirin is very well researched in terms of prevention of cancer. So for people who are at high risk of bowel cancer, it can reduce the risk of bowel cancer by about 50%. The data is less clear for some other types of cancers. Pancreatic cancer, for example, which is also related to BRCA genes. There was one report that suggested that taking aspirin actually increased the risk of pancreatic cancer. Aspirin is, by and large, pretty much as a preventative, is a kind of a wonder drug. It reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease, of stroke, and of multiple cancers. And I don't know what the data is like for ovary, or if there is data for ovary for someone who actually has the cancer. You can. So aspirin is what's known as a COX inhibitor. And the target in the cancers that's important is COX-2. In the lining of your stomach, you have a related protein called COX-1. And when you take that protein out, it damages the lining of the stomach. Only in about 10 or 20% of people does that happen. It depends on dose. The other thing about aspirin is that it can obviously increases your risk of bleeding. And so you wouldn't want to just start taking aspirin without your healthcare person knowing about it, because it can actually interact with drugs. Yeah. Yes. good question. So how important is the immune system, and is that an approach? Our lab doesn't work on that. I'm not an immunologist, and it's a very complex and highly refined area, so you need to sort of stick to your knitting. When I was director, we recruited a whole program in cancer immunology to Peter Mac, and there's a very active program in understanding the role of the immune system in preventing the development of cancers, and in using the immune system to fight cancers. And so that's a very active area of research at Peter Mac and in other places. I should say that in high-grade serous cancers, our work has shown that there is one group of women there who have a very active immune response to the tumour, and as a group, they do the best. So the immune system, in at least in high-grade serous cancers, and I suspect for other types of ovarian cancer, is important. It's actually important, and it probably potentially has a big impact on survival. So general well-being, I think, can be important in that sense. I think. Yeah, he's out that we can ask. Yeah, a really, really important area. Yeah?
My question
about pazopanib. Yes. Do you have any impressions of how that sort of treatment when you think about how it might relate to people with the BRCA mutation? So the question's about pazopanib, and is that useful, and does it relate to BRCA mutation? So pazopanib is what's known as a small molecule inhibitor. So small means that it's tiny. Really tiny, you can take it as a tablet. Aspirin is a small molecule inhibitor, a tiny little drug. And a molecule means it's like a protein, basically, and it inhibits it. So pazopanib is a small molecule inhibitor that's very closely related to sunitinib. It's better than sunitinib in the sense that it has a much lower toxicity profile, so it doesn't cause as many side effects as sunitinib. At the moment, the focus for sunitinib is mainly on clear cell cancers. And it's clear cell cancers rarely, if ever, but rarely practically, have BRCA mutations. So where sunitinib might also be trialled is in high-grade serous cancers along the lines of bevacizumab. But I think that the most activity we're going to see for sunitinib or pazopanib will be in clear cell cancers. Yeah, I mean, the main activity, so these are anti-angiogenics. They're things that stop blood vessels forming. the biggest activity in anti-angiogenics for ovary has been with bevacizumab. Thousands of women enrolled on those ICON 7, GOG 218 OCEAN studies. I'm not sure where sunitinib is at in terms of high-grade serous cancers. As I said, the example that I showed you was in clear cell cancers. There's a trial in NCI now in the US for sunitinib in clear cell cancer that will be reported on probably next year, I think. But to me, that drug seems to be most likely to be active in clear cell cancers, I think. Having said that, what we find is that cancer, it isn't like it's breast cancer or lung cancer. There was a beautiful paper just published overnight showing that we're gradually adding up in lung cancer really important different ways for it to become a lung cancer of targets. Sometimes they've got an ALK mutation, sometimes they've got a RET mutation, sometimes they've got an EGF receptor. You know, these are not homogeneous things. And so when you come along with a drug like sunitinib, you might get a response rate of 6%, which sounds terrible, but in those 6%, if they're the right 6%, if you can predict them, you could suddenly have a response rate of 100%. But it's just, we just can't expect drugs to work in everyone because there's so much variation. Yeah, so generally these things sort of asymptote down like that. And it has to do with type of cancer, stage of disease, and how the surgery went in response to the chemotherapy. Those four things really influence the likelihood of recurrence. And what you end up with is a probability. You know, how likely is it that it'll recur in 2 years? How likely in 3 years and so on? And those probabilities are calculated based on what happened to the last 1,000 people who are in the same situation as that person. And so, you know, you just essentially calculate a probability for that person. So for a particular person, you need to know those factors. You can't just simply say, oh, your risk is X. Does that explain it?
Yeah,
Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah, look, lots of people are cured, right? That's the first thing to say. And what tends to happen is that if you plot out the number that recur his surgery and his time, right? And the number that recur, it probably goes like that, and then it starts to fall down like that to none. And that peak will be over some point. It might be 2 years, might be 3 years, and it depends on who we're talking about. High-grade serous cancers, clear cell cancers, stage 1 disease, stage 2 disease, and so on. And so that curve may have moved because of data. I wish it wasn't the case that, you know, you get past 2 years or you get past 3 years and you've passed go, you know, you're home and free. But it starts to fall. And that's the way it is. Yeah. So hormone therapies that antagonize hormones like estrogen are really, really important in breast cancer. So one of the first things that people want to know in a breast cancer is it ER positive? Is it positive for the estrogen receptor? Because this is something that breast cancer cells need to grow. We know that ovarian cancers are often positive for ER and PR, and that in some women they will respond to tamoxifen. So tamoxifen, which is an inhibitor of estrogen, tends to be used in the sort of the second or third or fourth line setting, and it depends a bit on how well the woman is. So for breast cancer, we know a lot about that being very important. We know that the target is there in ovarian cancer. We know that some women respond, but we know that the responses are much less common than occur in breast cancer. And so we're involved now in an international study that's run out of Canada, actually, trying to answer that question. How important is it to know the ERPR status of different types of ovarian cancer, and can you use that information to think about anti-estrogen therapy? Because although it can be associated with hot flushes and things like that, it's something that people tolerate better than chemotherapy. So the short answer is trying to figure that out.
Ladies, will you join me in thanking David very much?
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.